Hello and welcome to the Volunteer Firefighter Podcast. My name is Ash and I'm joined with two of my fellow firefighters. I've got Todd.
Hello.
And we have Scott.
Hey there.
And we continue our journey on trying to figure out our audio situation. We're trying some new things here tonight. We are, two of three of us are in the same building, but not in the same room. And Scott's just up at his house on, I would say, minor quarantine. I think, but you feel okay just playing it safe?
Oh, no, I don't feel okay, but I don't have COVID. That's not a thing anymore. Because if you don't test, you don't have it.
That's right.
Nice. Yeah, exactly. That's how it goes nowadays.
All right. So we are sitting down. It is currently September the 10th, and it is the second Sunday of September. So that brings us to National Fallen Firefighter Memorial. Todd, I think you had some info on that.
Yeah, so it's in 2017, so I'm going to read here. So 2017, the Canadian federal government established the second Sunday in September as Firefighters National Memorial Day to coincide with the annual memorial service held in Ottawa each year. And this designation, of course, mandates all federal buildings and fire departments to place their flags, Canadian flags at half-mast on this day to honor all those firefighters who have died in the line of duty. So this is actually a big year this year. It's the 20th year in Ottawa since this has been going for the National Firefighters Memorial. And actually one of our past members, who is the retired chief of Anarchist Mountain, Wayne Jasper, he's out there. And he was representing his old department and everybody who else is there. But Wayne also, he was the... Where is he? So he was the Fallen Firefighters Foundation Line of Duty Death Chairman for many, many years. So he's out there helping represent and remember all the fallen firefighters to the families. And then our other past member, Sarah, she is currently full-time with Richmond Fire. She was out there as well. So she's introducing the medallions and helmets to all the families. So a pretty big day for her. So she posted on the social medias there and is pretty proud to be out there supporting and quite an honor to be representing.
Absolutely. I think before we go any further, somebody's phone is dangerously close to the microphone and I'm picking up some quick feedback, so we'll try to adjust that. But other than that, yeah, so it also being September the 10th, we are on the eve of September 11th, which... I mean, obviously, every firefighter out there and pretty much everybody in the world knows what happened September 11th.
Yeah, it's his wedding anniversary.
It is. Everybody out there knows that. It is my anniversary.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
so I think that's all we have to say about that.
Yeah, you know, so actually, just before we came up for recording on 60 Minutes on TV there, they're doing a news story about September 11th as well. And... you know, I'd forgotten about some of the stories that came out of it, and they're talking about it. They're showing pretty good video footage of the kind of the instant command posts, one of them that they had set up, and you can hear these thuds, and everybody just kind of pauses and looks around, and another thud, and those are the people jumping or falling out of the building. And they mentioned that the first firefighter who actually died that day was killed by a person who fell or jumped out of the building and landed on him. So... Pretty traumatizing, all the events that day. But it's pretty interesting just seeing the passion and dedication again that everybody had. Like, they were talking about some of the facial expressions and some of the words that were passed from duty officers and captains to the chiefs and battalion chiefs when they were given a task to go up to, like, the 72nd floor. And they just kind of nodded at each other, knowing that they may not come back. But they still, without a doubt, ran up there.
Yeah, definitely, man. There's such, like, heavy thoughts and feelings surrounding the day. You know, we always talk about every year, and it's just so much more than like a quick Facebook post or everybody puts up a quick photo of, you know, like that whole, like, you know, never forget or whatever, right? But like once you really dive into like hearing and like rereading stories, like Todd just said there about like the actual sounds from that day, you know, it kind of gives, shivers or whatever, right? It's such a different thing. And you start thinking about that trauma of the survivors and what, you know, living with that, you know, survivor guilt, is something crazy that, you know, you didn't really think about right away. But you are hearing more and more about that as years go on. People keep, every year it's such a major event, you know, around the world, definitely in the States. And then for firefighters, it's huge for every first responder is huge, right? So, we're so far removed now from way back then that it's many years ago now. And you forget some of these like stories and some of the things that, you know, you have probably heard once or twice along the way. And then being kind of reminded of what that would have been like, because I think everybody here would have reacted the exact same way. Like you're saying, like, hey, I want you up on X floor. Okay, that's what we're here to do. And you would march up there to go and do a job. Knowing what that outcome may actually look like.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, again, like just before I was leaving, I was watching on the TV there, and they were talking about once the first tower went down, the radio traffic, like it was just dead silence. Like there was no sound in the streets. Like they said, it was kind of like it was that eerie quietness of the first big snowfall, like just no noise anywhere other than the odd little radio chatter of a dispatcher. And then they actually played some of that that tape from the dispatchers. And I was expecting it, but it kind of hit me in the stomach and the throat just as I was saying bye to the kids to come up here, you know, hearing that dispatcher saying, you know, any battalion chief, any duty chief in command post at the towers can come in. Can you hear me? And there's no response. And they said, you know, that just kind of painted the picture that the mass amount of lives that they just suddenly lost. And it was just eerie hearing that again. And, I remember when it went down where I was, I was actually in paramedic school in the hotel. We're getting ready to go to class when it came in and we're watching it on the news. So it was, it's pretty eerie.
Yeah. So, you know, tomorrow is September 11th. And, I guess everybody listening will have their own way of looking back and reflecting. But, definitely a pretty heavy day. And, with that, we will move away from news and get into the bulk of the podcast tonight. We have a couple of things we're going to chat about. We held one of our field training exercises that's going back 2 weeks ago now. And Rob actually set it up with Jay. Jay was one of our captains. He's currently off on medical leave and he's been getting himself back into the department, which is amazing to see. Todd and I just saw him about an hour ago. He's out with one of our younger members doing some driver training. This fella, he doesn't have a lot of experience driving like large vehicles. He actually works for me, and our F-250 is probably the biggest thing that he has experience driving, and just still isn't very comfortable with it, to say the least. So Jay, being a very experienced driver, he's driven like highway truck for a long, long, long time now. So they went out, spent, I'd say, the last three weeks they've gone and, you know, kind of went and toured around. I think they started with like just a pickup truck and then moved up to our bush truck. And tonight they graduated to our water tender. So it's kind of like the first step in that. This is a big apparatus. You got that weight. It's not just another regular vehicle, and obviously getting away from hydraulic brakes and going towards the air brakes is definitely another big step for somebody that's not familiar with, you know, driving something of that size. So Jay is getting himself back. you know, getting back into the training, which is amazing to see him here. So he got really excited. He was helping, was helping Rob do our previous practices that were leading up to our FTX. They were just doing rope work. So getting the rope system out, getting the harnesses on guys, and just working them through the setup. So on the back end of that, what we've kind of worked towards, Scott came up with it. We take something that we just trained and then marry that with something that we're going to be training coming up. And that gives us a bit of a snapshot of, okay, how much of the training did we just retain? And then what are the key things that we have to focus on moving forward? So it's a nice way to, you know, have a look back at what we just did and then forward of like where we really need to focus on. So that's what built up to our recent scenario, which I guess neither of you guys were there. So, Scott, you were.
I can talk about that though.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like my thought on that was kind of like we build the ego up on one hand because you get them to do something they should know, like inside out. And actually, Jay and Rob, they did Wildland. Started off as a wildland scenario, and then it turned into an overembankment scenario, and then it was an auto extrication scenario. So it's kind of all three of those things. Obviously, we've been in a lot of wildland in the last several months, both in training and in reality. And then the ropes, like you said, Ash, they did some flatland training on the ropes, so basically had to set the rope system up, do some things. They didn't do really anything with the actual the angle. Which when we talk about this, it'll kind of, I don't want to say it comes back to haunt us, but there's a little bit of regret in there for that. But yeah, the idea is to like, we'll build our confidence up in one hand and then I don't want to say crush it in the other hand, but you know, you get some humility, cause you're like, yeah, I really know how to do all this stuff now. But then, we throw some other part of the scenario is something we haven't trained in several months, which is auto extrication. Mm-hmm. So, some of the newer guys, they barely seen the tools, cause they're very new. But again, it's a scenario. I can explain this last week to the crew when we had a meeting. I said, don't feel bad. I said, it's not meant to fail. It's meant to make you, push you to your limits. That's what it's really for. That's why I want to do it that way. If we spoon fed you like gave you the easy scenario every time, it would be, I mean, nothing, right? You wouldn't learn anything. You'd just be like, yeah, we're badass, where you can do whatever. But no, we want to give them a little bit of that hard candy, I guess. Of like, hey, maybe you don't know everything, but yeah.
You want to push them to give them that opportunity to make those decisions on their own and differentiate to see, okay, is that the right decision? If not, well, you stuck with it, and maybe there is a different option that you could use. But like I said, it's not that push to fail, but it's push to learn.
Yeah, I shouldn't say our guys weren't like, oh, we know everything. But you know, sometimes when you train someone, like if we only ever trained like hydrants, guys would be really, really good at hydrants, and they'd probably be pretty confident about it and probably pretty cocky about it. But we have to train all this other stuff, right?
Yeah, and in our scenarios and FTXs, that is kind of like what we do is we push the envelope and make it really challenging. And kind of the purpose of that is you want to see where that limit is. You want to see your limitations rather than, you know, if you're just doing basic, you know, basic skills, everybody that's here now should know basic skills. And I think everybody does. And even the rookies that don't have a lot of time on tools, they do understand the basics of AutoX. But when you start to layer some of it on, I mean, that's where that knowledge and that skill set is tested. So that definitely came into play. I know one of our officers was, I don't want to say mad, but he's like, it's like, what the shit? Like I have these fucking rookies down here that don't have much experience on these tools. And now I've got this semi-complex rescue, which is true. But they got the job done. They made it happen. So is there still like a shit ton of learning that we can do? Absolutely. But there's nothing saying that, you know, that might not be the truck that you get as well. Like anytime that we try to do these FTXs and like we kind of model the trucks off of, all right, this person's strong with this, this person's strong with this. Well, now we're right back to that same sort of scenario where, you know what, like you might have a group of four firefighters with you that are really strong in a skill set. Like, what are the odds that they're all going to be driving past the fire hall when that AutoX call comes in? Like, it's not going to happen. Just on a side story, we had, like, we got slammed actually yesterday. We had, like, three simultaneous calls back to back to back. One of them was not much. There wasn't a lot of skill set involved. We had a vehicle fire right in the middle of the street, which car fires are, you know, very easy. It's not like a ton of skill. It's that classic bread and butter, you know, a couple hose lines, a couple teams, and you can get it done very safely and very, very effectively. But when the call came in, our first truck was out, and that's like our first truck generally rolls with like pretty skilled firefighters, just kind of the way everything rolls. And that was the case. So we had a truck full of really switched on guys. And I happened to be a little slower getting to the hall. So I missed the call. So I'm sitting here with, one of our good drivers and then two of our rookies, like super rookies. And this second call comes in for a vehicle fire. And I'm looking in the back, and then it's like right across the street from the fire hall base. You know, it's across the street, across the highway, but 2 minute response time. And I'm like, man, like, could we get this done? 100%. But we've got that like stack truck that's a couple blocks away. Let's sit and wait and see if we have any other people show up just so we can put our best foot forward. And you know, the first truck didn't end up beating us, but you just kind of look back, and that's when you're making that snap call of like, am I satisfied with the skill set of the people that are on this truck to leave? And if we didn't have the other truck that was like, I knew whereabouts those guys were, if I didn't know that, and this was like, we were the first four in and we're ready to rock, would we have went 100%? And we would have got the job done. But again, knowing that there's the other truck with that skill set, but that's just the reality of what you might see is you might get that kind of a truck, and you just have to change your tactics a bit until some, you know, until some more experience comes on. I mean, every aspect of a call is going to be dictated by the people that you have. So
I'm chuckling to myself here because the multiple calls you guys had all at once there, I'm thinking back to the video I shared with you guys the other day about, the media portrayed Vancouver Fire. They said, oh, Vancouver Fire stretched thin. They had two calls at once, two fires at the same time. And I was like, ooh, with all their fucking resources coming out of their ass everywhere. And one was a boat, so they had fire boats and separate teams. How did they do it? Sorry, no, not a slam to Vancouver, a slam to the media.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of a dumb media story, two calls at once. It seemed like, I think if I was a Vancouver firefighter, I'd be pretty mad at them because it makes them sound like they, I don't know, like they can't handle two calls. It's like, man, they're
it totally made them sound like that. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, so anyway, back to the actual scenario. So to kind of paint the picture of it, so we show up to the hall. Everybody knows it's going to be scenario night. So the teams are getting the scenario ready. Rob enlisted his wife and mine actually to be patient. So I kind of already knew that there was going to be some patience somewhere around. So I was chatting with Rob. I'm like, I know a little bit, but not like I don't know what this whole scenario is going to look like. So I'm like, do you want me? I was the duty officer that week. So I'm like, do you want me to be IC? Do you want me to be in a truck? And he's like, well, let's just see what other officers that we have here. Let's see what the chief and the deputy are doing. And it turned out that the chief was going to be leaving early that day. So he's like, okay, like you will stay as command and just kind of shut off your brain with what you think you might know. I'm like, okay, fine. So we're doing our pre-meeting. Those guys are out getting everything ready. And then the call comes in for grass fire right down the street from the fire hall. If you're going, if you're looking north, if you're standing where the grass fire would have originated, to the east is going to be down a bit of a draw, is a large fuel station. And then across the street is a controlled atmosphere, packing house storage facility. So, like, big ammonia, like, high concern if fire obviously gets and starts to impinge that building. So that was the initial call out. So you obviously deal with the initial threat. So I got on scene, and it's all pretend, obviously. So Jason hopped in the officer truck with me, and he was like my eyes to like paint that picture for me. So I'm like, hey, what do I see? He's like, hey, you got fire rocking pretty good on the left side of the street. It is starting to spot fire to the right. You will notice you'll start to see some cones, and cones were going to be our fire. I'm like, okay, fine. So I set up shop, and I asked for our first due was going to go and position themselves down and be protection for the fuel station. Cause if that thing got going, that was going to be a major issue. Second engine left. Actually, there was an issue, so our second engine rolled first. I don't know what the deal was, but the first truck was slow to respond. They had some issue, so the second engine left first. So they got down to the bottom, and then our first engine, once it did leave, I got them to. They were tasked for the CA of the fire, so the spot fires that were starting to encroach upon the packing house. So those guys got a bump and run set up, and they were actually in the fire. Crews that went down to the fuel station did a really quick job of getting lines stretched. It's funny, the officer in his mind is saying, let's grab the pre-connect forestry line, but he says grab the pre-connect, like, because we've been hammering forestry. So I think it was like another one of those, like, they know what I want, but he said grab the pre-connects, which is going to be structure. So they did right. Grab that, which is fine. You definitely get a lot more water out of it, but you're going to use a lot more when you're not attached to a hydrant. So they got tied up on the re-rack a little bit there. But they made really quick work of the bottom half there. They got the major fire knocked down like really, really quick. So while this is all happening, we still have a few members back of the hall. And a good point of note is our bush truck was up in Lillooet on forestry deployment still. So that would be, it's either going to be a water tender or a bush truck's going to be coming out next. So I kept some people back of the hall in case we did need some more water. And I got our side-by-side, so like our bush 182. I got a group of three on that unit to do tactical patrol, just to make sure that we had no more spot fires or anything else. And also I knew Rob had more to kind of come, right? So those guys started to do some tactical patrols and came across a vehicle, which is what would have started the fire. So the vehicle, you know, crashed, slid off the road for whatever reason. We didn't know yet why. Sparks or heat from the exhaust ignited the dry grasses, which is very, very possible in our area now. And that's what started the fire. So there was no concern for safety at where the vehicle incident was, but there was two patients that were trapped there. So now that we've got the major fire knocked down, we want to start to put resources towards these two patients. So one of our seasoned firefighters, he's, you know, really switched on. He's been around for a while. I basically said, okay, well, I'm over here on command. I want you to be lead on everything patient care now. So whatever you need, because they were just in our side-by-side. So they had zero resources, and I couldn't see anything. So I'm like, you are in charge of that. So I want you to direct whatever resources that you think that you need. And I basically did like a quick par for where everybody was and what their status was. And engine 182 was wrapping up down at the bottom. So I said to Mike, I'm like, Mike, if you need them, I can release them, leave engine 181 to stay on any sort of hot spots and anything else and get those guys up to you. And he was happy with that. And then the base, like the hall here, said that they had three more members that were available. So we got them to bring out our rescue truck, which has everything. Our second engine actually has a lot of the rescue equipment, but it's not set up for ropes. So you could do some like quick and dirty rope work, but all of our like rescue rope system that's preset and ready to rock is on our rescue truck. So we got that over at that point and the rescue started. So I don't know if you guys have any questions. I don't want to keep rambling.
So once your rescue crew got there, you had a crew of three on rescue?
Yeah, so a crew of three on rescue. There was the original crew of three on Bush. So they ended up having a total of five working firefighters with Mike running the rescue. So, yeah. I mean, that's a pretty minimal for what they were about to do. Yeah. That's a pretty minimal crew. So we knew, Mike knew right away as well, that he was going to start to need some more resources coming.
Yeah, and that's always a tricky thing, right? Like when you end up just having like five guys, because generally in like the rescue truck, like anytime you're doing whether it's AutoX or if it's a rope scenario, five guys is pretty thin. Yeah. Now you mix into, okay, we got to get the rope system set up, we got to get the basket set up, we got to get patient care going, we need the extrication tools. Like there's a lot of moving parts here. And with the vehicle, was it on its side, roof, four wheels? What was it?
Yeah, so the guys actually, it was as it lied. So they rolled it down the bank and it kind of came to rest like half on, I guess it was driver's side low. I don't know if it was up against a tree or something, but it was driver's side low with passenger side up in the air some. It was definitely not stable, to say the least. So
yeah, when you think of back to your manpower, like so now you got to get guys down the bank, and what type of bank is it? Is it can we safely walk down it with some equipment to do a quick and dirty stabilization, or do we actually need guys in harnesses and sending stuff down? Mm-hmm. That ties into it. Did you guys have to have them tethered to go down, or were they able to walk down and stabilize and then just the rope system for the patients?
So we ended up throwing one rope over and just a quick dirty belay line just to guide patient care firefighters down. And then it was like pretty sandy, pretty shitty. I mean, it wasn't the easiest spot, to say the least. So it did require, for like work purposes, it definitely required harnesses and the basket stretcher. So as they were making patient contact, as they were getting some quick and dirty stabilization, two firefighters ended up getting inside of the vehicle with them just to support the patients because, mechanism of injury. The vehicle rolled. There was some pretty substantial injuries, right, just based on the way that the vehicle rolled. And like one of them, Rob's wife had, I believe when the vehicle went over, her legs were up on the dash, which when the airbags went off, made some pretty significant damages to the lower extremities, mm-hmm, pelvis and such, right? So, yeah, Kath had, she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and she took some, I don't know if it was an impact or if it was just glass as everything was rolling. So she, like, this is obviously not not real. Let's just
get pretend. That
but as the vehicle rolled and glass was shattering, she got some pretty good lacerations to the head and face, which is obviously, you know, pretty concerning as well, because the face and the head bleed pretty all right. So there was crew inside right away once stabilization. There was a group of three that got into a harness. I believe they used the basket, so they strapped the rescue equipment in it, as well as some extra medical gear and a water extinguisher to go over the bank and basically get themselves set up for rescue. So, at that point, basically, once the tools were down, once everything else was good, our first engine said that, you know, fire was clear. Rob is, yes, you know, you guys got all the fire action. So they ended up getting another crew of five that came up and then got into the work, which, you know, you have to think there's going to be a minimum of two now inside of the vehicle, two doing the auto X side of it, three are in a harness. Like, we're starting to eat up manpower pretty quick, and then we still need people to work the rope system up on the high side. Like, at one point, Mike and myself were on the haul line because that's just what you need to do in that kind of a scenario, right?
And, you know, like, real world stuff too. Like, there's been many calls where we've been on where, you know, it's out of district and we've got five on the rescue and we'll pair it with a second truck. So usually now we've changed our strategy because we have a bush truck now that will respond to back up for rescues as well. But before that it was our duty truck with a handful of people in as well. So you'd have your anchor and change of direction, et cetera. But, you still need more manpower for those haul lines for a lot of time. So we've tasked, hey, paramedics, hey, cop, grab the line and help pulling, right? And get that haul line going. And it's just what you have to do. You grab the other bodies that are on scene to help you pull.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, realistic, like those, the injuries that you guys simulated, very, very realistic injuries. We've all had those types of calls where the legs have been up and you get multiple nasty fractures because the ankle went down from down low to up by your ears and you're not bending in the right spots. So it's good FR practice, right? Just the basic trauma management, basic trauma splinting, your other concerns. So that's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, basically it was pretty standard rescue from that point forward. Adam, one of our officers, was leading the extrication portion of it and ended up doing a lot of the work just because he was paired up with two of our rookies. And again, that's just the way she goes, right? So he was getting them to do like soft protection. He was getting them to help hold the door as it was popping. So all they really did was just pop both driver and passenger door and then assisted the patients out. Which, you know, that's, I'd say 50-60% of the time exactly what you're going to do with that scenario. We did on the back end come back and talk about, you know, different things that we could have done, right or wrong. Like, it was definitely not anything towards like, hey, you guys did this wrong. It was more of a, I mean, there's 1,000 ways that this could have went. What do you think about this? What do you think about this? Right. So that was in our debrief. And I think a lot of people, I think a lot of the crew could see that. Yeah. I think we could have A, with more help and B, if we had the time, which they with, having no true medics there, they were getting their feedback from two of our members that had just completed their FR training and aren't even like licensed yet. So they've got the skill set, but no real world experience. So in a scenario, they're like, "Hey, like, what kind of rush are we in to get these patients out?" And to their knowledge, they're like, yeah, this is like a pretty big rush. Like, let's make it happen. So they with as much patient care as possible, got got the two girls out as quickly as possible. And they were, like, when we asked them afterwards, they said that they were really, really cautious with how they were moving their bodies. And so, you know, definitely commend the guys on that side of it as well. But, you know, talk about, let's get that B-post right out of the way. Let's maybe get that roof right out of the way. You know, because the vehicle is up on a funny angle, we do have a short ladder on the rescue truck that you know, you could have used that to get a bit of a height angle on it so you can work a little bit easier. But, you know, again, it's, you don't want to pick apart these scenarios and these calls when you have a positive outcome. But you also, like, the last thing that we want to do is go around the circle, pat everybody on their back and say that was perfect, because it doesn't matter what it is. If it's an alarm call, a structure fire, well, whatever it is, and MVA like this with multiple patients, there's always going to be room for improvement. So yeah, you know, we just kind of touched on, hey, like, what if we tried this? What if we tried that? And when you're the guy who's planning it, which is Rob and Jay, and, you know, when it's myself and Mike that are just sitting there watching things unfold, you have a bit of a different eyesight to it, right? So other than that, I think everything went really, really well. We did have some, like, our Scott's two stars on a wish or whatever would be, like, the stars where the guys worked really, really hard, took it really serious. Their patient care, like, the people inside the vehicle got major, major props. The wish would be kind of twofold for me. You know, resource management, knowing that we ended up having some pretty big rookies down at the bottom. If right. we had the time, once more manpower was available, let's maybe switch those guys out, because we did get some pretty experienced people coming as the scenario evolved. So maybe some resource management, as well as just added training on that basket. The crew didn't rig up the basket as well as they should, and they stumbled. Actually, the first time they did it pretty damn good, and then they ended up adjusting it and tried something else, and they learned soon following that that wasn't really the move. So just getting that basket, like, high and tight to your waist, definitely makes it a lot less challenging when it is a very challenging haul.
Yeah. Well, you know, just going back a little bit too, like you mentioned, like, different ways to take people out and different actions to the car, things like that. Like, what we've always said before, like, the patient's conditions are going to dictate our response, right? Like, I always preach that to our guys.
Absolutely. And
throwing a bone out to Dr. Nick Sparrow from RTAC, the attack group. So good old Samurai Laser. You guys remember that one?
Yeah.
So, I'll post it here quickly. So the Samurai Laser, so I'll read it off. So basically, again, we always want to think simple, right? So we're thinking patient extrication and auto extrication. So you got your method, your speed, and your route, right? So under method, you got self-extrication, assisted, and manual extrication, and then, of course, the speed. So is it urgent, is it rapid, or is it immediate extrication? So that's going to dictate, that patient's condition is going to dictate that speed response. And then the route, of course, is how are we going to get them out? Like, you guys took them out a very simple way, the doors and out the side. So you got your linear way, your angled, side, and then, of course, emergency extrication. So talking like cars on fire, or need to get them out, or if there's like a critical injury and we need a massive intervention, or they're going to die, and we can't do it in the car, that's an emergency extrication. We just quick and dirty grab, rip them out, right? For that. And then, of course, relocate. So when we talk about relocate, it's not our typical extrication, but it's like the classic one I talk about with a relocation in that scenario is like that underride, right? So if you've got to have a car stove under a semi-trailer, and if you can't properly, if you need to do like a dash lift or something to get that lower impingement injuries out, it's very hard when you got something that heavy on top. So maybe we're stabilizing and then relocating the vehicle, so you're going to actually yank that vehicle out a bit. And that's the relocate, and then we do our extrication from there. So again, Dr. Nick Sparrow from the ATAC group and the RTAC program, that Samurai Laser acronym is fantastic. It's a big acronym, a lot to remember, but when you read through the basics, it's stuff that we already do, what we already think about. So think simple and then get complexed. And it sounds like that's exactly what you guys did. And then you debriefed about the more complex and different ways to do it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found a lot of really good feedback when we do these, you know, immediate debriefs. So we got the crew back to the hall. We got everybody, you know, out of their gear, left a couple of the trucks outside, and just use the bays where we could have everybody's focus. And, you know, we always kind of go around the table, if you will, and get, like, the officers or the team lead's view on how they thought it went. And I find our people are more critical on themselves than we will be, right? So you really don't need to do, like, you don't have to give them the shit because they're already saying it. You know, and if a couple things are missed, that's kind of when, okay, we can jump in and, you know, definitely manage that side of it, you know, in a positive light. Like if things went like super sideways, obviously you would have to address that. And we would probably, if it was really sideways, we'd probably call a bit of an all stop right on the scenario, because you don't want to A, see somebody get hurt, or B, give super bad tactics where, you know, that's something that, yes, if somebody's not super, you know, super switched on, now that's their first core memory of this is what I'm supposed to do, and this is super shitty.
Yeah, you don't want those little training scripts, right?
Yeah, so that's really the only time that, like, I can see myself saying something right away, kind of that big circle debrief, just going around. And then we also open it up to anybody out on the floor. So anybody that was out there, because everybody has a different point of view. Like, I don't see everything that happens down at the bottom unless I'm down there. So Adam was down there, but also was four other people. So, you know, Adam gave his couple cents of what he thought, and everything he said was valid. And then a couple of the people down at the bottom had a couple points, which were also very, you know, very, very valid. So we take those things back, and which now is going to be what we're going to be training for the next month. So we have a couple vehicles set up, and I'm actually trying to line up a couple more. We might have the opportunity to get a few extra vehicles for the month, just to keep guys working. And then, you know, really, really hit on, now we can really hit on, like, the bread and butter, but also, like, that next step, like we were just saying, like, hey, pop in that door and getting the patient out, perfect. But can you be better than perfect? Sure. Depending what the scenario looks like, right? I mean, it doesn't make any fucking sense, but, like, there's always opportunity to be better. Time, manpower, everything, you know, dependent. So we're just going to build off of that for the next month now.
Awesome. Well, like you said, like, we're always our own worst critic, right? And that's why those immediate debriefs are super helpful, because that's what I like doing too. Like, if I'm, whatever role I'm in, when it comes to me, I'll say, hey, this is what I thought was best at that time. This is what I could have done better. Like Scott, you said, the two stars and a wish, right? Like, you know, and having newer people, new recruits and rookies, see that we're comfortable saying, hey, I made a mistake, I could have done this better. Or there's another avenue of doing it. That just shows them that, hey, look, like, we're all in it together. And there's the importance of this training is this is where we want to make the mistakes to learn from.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important that they always go back to, what's important now too. Cause that scenario sounds pretty crazy. Like, it's like, you get a wildfire, then you get a MBA, then you get a new, overmagnet. When you break it down, you layer it, like, to what's important now. It's like, okay, well, right now the fire is important, so let's deal with that. That's easy to deal with. We know how to do that. Grass fire, no problem. Okay, now what's important? Oh, we found this vehicle down the hill. Okay, sent some members over. Check it out. Oh, two patients. Okay, so now we got to extricate, and we got to bring them up the hill. So we can do two things at once. We can set the basket stretcher up and start the extrication. So it's a bunch of kind of bread and butter things, but they're just layered into one big scenario. Is that scenario realistic? It could happen. You know, a car goes over the hill, lights a grass fire. Next thing you got exactly that scenario going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So And that's how we always kind of make it happen. We try to, we want them to kind of understand that what's important now and go back to the layering.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, kind of what I like looking at too is with that, with the WIN principle of what's important now is also like the SMART method we've talked about in the past. Like, you know, it's got to be specific. It's got to be measurable. It's got to be achievable and realistic. And then we need a timestamp to it. Like, can it be realistic and achievable in a certain time frame? So, like, and that ties hand in hand with what's important now, right? So, as long as whoever the team leads are and people are thinking those lines, you can apply those principles to everything we do.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, so in a major nutshell, that was what that scenario looked like. I think, again, major hats off to everybody that was involved in it. Awesome job setting it up to Jason and Rob.
I think the people and people in this town are pretty cool too, because not many towns are going to let you throw a car off a hill.
No.
Right in town.
Like, literally.
We literally drove a car off of a hill and rolled it down a cliff.
Yeah. Man, if we did that in our town, people would shit.
But, you know, we got everything. I mean, we picked up most of the debris and pulled it back up the hill, and no one's the wiser. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's great. I think it's
fantastic. It's a totally realistic scenario in the location it was.
Yeah, 100%. Definitely. Great. Like, I mean, it's funny. So just kind of one last thing. Rob says to the girls, like, you know, use your acting skills, which I don't know about Melissa, but Cass has none. Chatting. They're kind of chatting together, like, I don't know what we're going to do. Like, what do you think? And, I'm thinking I might have this. Like, why are we down here, right? Like, obviously, they had to get there.
Going to labor.
Yeah, Cass is, she was the driver. And when the first person comes to the door, like, oh, what are you doing here? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I don't know. I swerved for a deer. Blah, blah, blah. And then she's like, oh, man, I was texting. Yeah. I was texting. And I didn't see where I was going. Oh, okay. Have you guys been drinking tonight? No. Ah, I've been drinking all night, right? So, like as things are going, just like some of the best acting ever, I guess. So yeah, it was funny, but I mean that makes things very, very, you know, realistic. You know, there's going to be alcohol on board. Obviously, they weren't paying attention, went off the road there, and like the other funny thing that happened. So they were in there they were probably in the vehicle for an hour and a half, because we were a little bit delayed getting everything started. So they were probably sitting in there for the better part of a half an hour before, like, we even got paged out. So it was getting dusk when we started. It was dark at the end of it. So as she's coming out of the vehicle, she couldn't really tell if, like, you know, what the weather was like, what else was going on, because there's bright lights shining down at you now. And as she's coming out, getting, like, strapped into the basket, she's like, oh, is it raining? And Adam's like, nope, that's all my sweat. She's like, gross. So gross. So, but everybody worked really hard, obviously. So, yeah, so anyway, that was our scenario. Again, we try to do one of those a month. We think it's very, very beneficial to kind of set up training for the next month, as well as testing that skill set from the previous. I think Scott's got a really good system worked out there, and thinking we're going to see some big, big benefits from it. So scenario was wrapped. And then for us last week, we had a bit of a shift in some of our operations and came up with another opportunity to train. So Scott, why don't you tell us what we got up to?
Yeah, so we've shortened one of our operations meetings down to a little less time for the meeting, which allows us for an extra about an hour and a half of training, which really helps because with the BC standards that we have to follow, standards that everybody has to follow throughout the world, the more training the better, and in order to meet that compliance level, you have to train. So. The idea is this, since it's a shorter practice, because usually our practices are two and a half hours long. This one's a shorter practice, so it's purely a skill-based practice. There's no scenario, not much teaching. It's going to be more They shouldn't already know this. It's more like a refresher. So the idea is, basically I'm going to take one of those standard skills that every firefighter should know. And we're going to basically do that every month. And that's a whole group practice. So this one happened to be, hydrants. So what we did, we took 2 engines, rescue truck, 2 tenders. So basically our whole fleet. We're going to take a bush truck, but we actually managed to put another guy onto the rescue truck. So, rescue truck doesn't usually hit a hydrant, but, it's easy to do. The idea for the night was we didn't need to deploy hose. We didn't need to do that whole rigmarole with the hose deployment and all that stuff. Because that was not what the skill was about. The skill was about how to effectively, attach yourself to a hydrant and like set up the gate valves, set up, you know, and get ready to go flush, all that kind of stuff. So every truck, and then I also saw it as an opportunity to use it as a communications night as well. So what we did, energizing night. So I went around earlier in the day, drove around, made sure that the hydrants we were going to use were usable. And we weren't going to wash someone's like driveway out or destroy someone's like landscape. Because on a real fire, we don't care, but on a training night, we want to make it, you know, want to make it good. We don't want to destroy people's property for no reason. So, went around, marked a bunch of hydrants, wrote them down, and then I gave like a list to the deputy chief who was acting as our dispatcher. And then what would happen is every time the truck, when the truck is ready with its members on board, and I kind of put the members, I put kind of new people, some senior guys, and kind of did it that way. So every truck, before it rolled out from the bay, the officer would have to call dispatch asking for an address. So all that he had was the corner of such and such and such and such, and that's where the hydrant was. And the idea was the truck would respond there. Once they got on scene, the officer would say, engine 181 on scene at, and then what I told him to do is find the nearest address they could find. So not the actual like cross street, like what's the nearest address? And what's the nearest building or what's that building attached or that address attached to? So they would have to say like, you know, I'm at such and such address. It's a single family home, nothing showing, just to get that extra little bit of radio communication with dispatch. And then, pump operator would get out. They'd do their thing. And then the person hit the hydrant would do their thing. And basically, we did that. And then what would happen is everybody would switch roles. So there'd be a new officer, new driver, new person hitting the hydrant. Some people's like Ash had some pretty new trucks, so I don't think there's a lot of driver switches.
There was none.
No. But the idea was if we had guys that were fully capable of driving and pumping and all that, they would jump on the pump panel, pump deck. Which, I mean, it's fine too, because a rescue truck doesn't really have it's not a complicated pump that we would flow often. It's just, you know, it's more of a backup pump. We don't really use it for much. So, the engine was more important to have the kind of senior guys on. And anyways, they did that throughout the night. And then before they left, every time they would have to say, engine 181, task complete, par 5. Just because we want to get into that, giving that personal accountability report. I really like that in forestry, how we're always making sure, double checking, triple checking that we have the same amount of crew on board that we left with. And no one gets left behind. So we did that all night. Took about, I would say like an hour and a bit. Went around. As we went around, we left all the caps off the hydrants to allow them to drain because winter is coming. And then Canada, we cannot leave our hydrants. If we cap them too fast, the water actually stays above ground and might not drain out. And then we have issues when that frost hits. So got the trucks to drive around, finish their tasks, and then come back and recap all the hydrants in reverse order from the order where they went through. So plenty of time to drain. Yeah, that was our night. So moving forward in the future, like possibly next time might be a knots night. Hour worth of knots. Next time will be, and then that time after that would be SCBA review, force entry, that kind of stuff. So just these kind of core skills that don't take a lot of teaching because they should already know them. It's just kind of reminder skills and checks
that box. Basics.
Yeah.
Yeah, like every year we have an annual like skills night. that, you know, we set out pumping, we set out force entry, we set out ropes, we set out like 1.5, 2.5 inch hose handling, throwing ladders, things like that, like the super basic stuff that like everybody needs to have hands on, and there's zero instruction. So it's just they have to go and do it. They hit one station that takes 15 minutes, and then they move on to the next. And, like, I kind of see these nights as like those type of skills, like the very, very basics, like things, again, that we don't really, like, once you're through your first say year, like, all of these skills should be ingrained, but it's just that quick refresher, that quick hands-on. You know, you might not be the person that's going to be, you know, going out there and capturing the hydrant. I can't even remember the last time that I had to live, because I'm 99.9% going to be in the jump seat. But getting out there and getting hands-on goes a long way. It's just, it's an easy task, something that we all know how to do well. But with our new hydrant kit, we've got, like, the big hydrant wrench, but we also have some smaller spanners from Modus. And it was cool to see the guys, rather than fumbling around with the big hydrant wrench to get your gate valves secure, after the first time that we hit the hydrant, they started to grab the smaller spanners because it was faster. So they learned, as the night progressed, the most efficient way to get water flowing fast. And it was really, really cool to see. And again, like Scott mentioned, like, our crew was super, like, I had a lot of the rookies with me. And then one of our firefighters that is coming off of a back injury, so he's not, like, racing in and out of the truck, so I didn't want to ask him to do anything other than he's just there for more of a mentorship. And then Mike actually was our driver. So between Mike and I, we were, again, more like the helpful eyes, and the three rookies did, I'd say, the lion's share of the work. We did look at the pumps, but to get the pump going in that truck, you actually have to hook up a hose line. You can't just blow it out the side like you can on an engine. So we just went over the pumps. Those guys didn't drive, but we got those newer members on the radio, which is funny. So one of them, like, has, like, came up through cadets and is, like, halfway through his pilot's license. So he has a lot of experience talking on the radio, but he's like, man, this is a different scenario. Like, I know there's 20 plus other people that are about to hear me. And he got in his own head and he made fun of himself afterwards. He's like, what the hell is wrong with me? I'm like, hey, man, this is why we do these things, right? And, like, it was funny. We were at our local Chevron, and, like, I could see the address. So I give him the address, and, like, three times in a row, he's like, I have no idea. And because there's so many crews working, people are talking over each other. And, like, I'm like, this is realistic as well. So, like, being the officer that has to go out there and, like, wait for your chance to speak, I'm like, that is what you're going to see. And, like, you know, saying that we're on scene isn't that important, realistically, as long as we know that. So your crew's already out working, right? So he's sitting there with the radio, I'm over watching the crews do their work, and I'm like, just wait until there's a bit of a lull in traffic and then hop on there and say it. And everybody did really, really well, and, you know, they probably won't be on the radio for another year. But, you know, it's just getting their feet wet and getting, you know, that, hey, you, it's me, you know, radio etiquette, and not, like, talking directly into the mic and trying to swallow the microphone and yell. Just having that simple, you know, radio etiquette when you learn it in a non-stressful environment. Because on our water tenders, like, you could be the guy. Like, we try to have an officer on every truck, but on a tender isn't really a, like, an officered truck. You're going to have a senior firefighter there. And it might be an officer if there's one available, but if there's not, it could be you. So getting on the radio and having that, you know, a little bit of confidence or whatever would go a long way. So yeah, it was a really awesome night. It was quick, it was easy. And coming off the back of the meeting, we actually had some pretty good feedback from it. So looking forward to next month.
I thought the trick is with the radio etiquette is getting practice, like you said, getting confident and comfortable, but also thinking before you speak and staying calm. Staying calm on a real scenario over the radio just sets the table nicely for everybody else. If the first couple people on the radio are just really amped up and you can hear it in their voice, everybody else gets a little bit elevated in the other oncoming trucks. So you stay calm and cool and collect. Generally, that's what you're going to get back. So and it takes practice.
Yeah. Let's go back to that story that Leif from Jocko and Leif tell in their podcast about how at Standby to Get Some, that we now have written on our seminar shirts, but they started doing that because they were trying to see how calm they could be, even though they're about to get in a gunfight. So they stand by to get some, like super calm, and then they're literally about to get in a gun battle. So there's potentially life injuries that we could get into too, but I couldn't imagine the stress level of those guys. And then, you know, things what we deal with sometimes. So yeah, I try to, you know, take that breath and think how chill I can be when I'm talking on the radio. I almost want to put people to sleep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sweet. Well, that kind of wraps up our side of it. But Todd, you guys got into a couple things over the past few days. You had a vehicle into a structure.
Yeah, so I was at work. I missed the show, but sounds like the crew, they responded to a car into a house. So it looks like this car plowed right down the street and didn't turn right into the side of a garage, through the garage, ended up hitting the car inside and moving it quite a substantial ways. Patient was already out upon their arrival and whatnot, but then, of course, our other role is stabilizing the scene and making sure things are safe. And just logistically, it changes things, right? So now we have structural integrity issues in that building. Uh-huh. And the typical, you know, a tow truck comes up pretty quickly and says, oh, I'm just going to hook onto it and yank it out. Like, maybe not. So it sounds like the guys told him, like, no, you got, we need some shoring and some other things being done here before you start doing that. So, of course, they worked with the police and whoever else they needed to and to get that stuff done safely. But you know, you look at that picture, so if you paint that as the patient was still in that car, we actually had to extricate now. There's a lot of extra moving parts there, if you will. Like, you know, we got the vehicle we have to deal with, the patient, and then now this potential structure that's lost its integrity. We got to think about extra shoring and how we're going to do that. What are we going to use? So I think they had a pretty good debrief about it. But again, you just never know what's going to happen and get thrown at you, right?
Yeah, you know, the big picture stuff, right? Like, you know, we talk about, you know, using the tools, like what does that scene kind of look like? And, you know, like if it was a underride and you had to, you know, remove the vehicle, if it's smashed into a house and now you have stability issues, you know, hats off to the people that slowed that down. I think is like really, really key. Tough one of those to train as well, right? Like, how do you, you know, you can kind of chat about it, but all right, guys, like we're going to, and like leave it to us. I'm sure we'll try to think of it now, but you know, we got some extra lumber. Yeah, we can make something. Yeah. The wheels are turning, right? But, you know, like that's generally going to be something that you discuss, but, I mean, stand by for a month or two and maybe that'll be our next scenario. I don't know.
But yeah, like training project in the training grounds.
Yeah, how do you train that, right?
What
happens if it catches on fire too?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other matters.
Yeah, actually one of the other officers was kind of giving me a little update after the event because I was curious, and he mentioned that as well. He's like, man, if that vehicle caught fire and it was in there, that structure, like it would have been chaos because it was like the soffits were all down, the ceiling was down, it would have been up into the ceiling and attic space right away. So that would have changed everything. And initially, of course, they responded with the rescue with our normal compliments, so our rescue, our brush truck, how we respond to our MVIs. But then again, thinking it's okay if it's a house, what now? Like maybe we should be setting an engine. You may beat this to death, but yeah, things to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then, yeah, what else did we get up to? A few other just the usual stuff, some alarm calls, some other minor MVAs and whatnot. Then we had a motorbike incident today on the drag strip, which is the airport in town. So we responded to that. And on that, I just want to talk kind of a reminder on driving etiquette and safety, right? So basically, everybody, you got to remember our rules and regulations for Code 3 driving, number one. We can't just be blowing stop signs and red lights. For anything, we have to come to a complete stop and make sure it's clear. And anytime we're going into that oncoming lane, we're asking permission to go in that. So we have to be reading traffic and looking at the big picture. So I've been fortunate. I've been in the emergency services for a long time and driving ambulance for a long, long time through the GVRD and the Lower Mainland. So I had a lot of experience in some pretty crazy traffic areas. And one thing I always really try and teach and preach is just that situational awareness, right? Constantly scanning, looking ahead at those intersections, looking for those stale green lights, the cues that when that light's going to be changing. What's the traffic congestion looking like? What are the brake lights showing you? Watching the pedestrians on the side of the road. Like there's so many things to be looking at. And of course, the usual stuff, the driving conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And we're in fire trucks. They're heavy. That water weight, you don't stop on a dime like you do in your personal vehicle when you're driving Code 3. So choose the adequate and appropriate speed. So today's event, I was actually driving our brush truck, and we were coming up to an intersection. Light was green our way, but everybody saw us coming. They yielded. They held in the one lane. We had to go around into the oncoming to get enter this intersection to make a left turn. And I could see the car trying to make a left into my lane, which is the oncoming now. They were still sitting in one spot, and I was watching the pedestrians, actually, and I'm watching their faces and body language, and they were kind of looking like, oh, man, this looks like this car is going to come. So they were making motions to the car to stay where you were. So I saw it, so I started slowing down already and watching them ahead of the pile of other vehicles that were stopped. And sure enough, as we approach even closer now, we're probably, 6-7 cars in front of us coming up to the intersection, and they gun it right into our lane. And I could already see them moving, and I saw the pedestrians on the sidewalk, their faces and their body language, like, oh, here it comes, right? And so we had a lot of safe room, so we just hovered over to the left. They saw us, they panic braked, and we went around them safely. But an inexperienced driver, if you're not watching those other vehicles and really leaving yourself enough time to slow down and read that, you can get into a lot of trouble. So you got to, just another reminder to really, really watch and pay attention. Like, don't get distracted when you're driving. If you're driving, that's your role. Read that traffic, look well ahead, and pay attention. Don't get sucked into too much other stuff.
Yeah, I think that's really key. I want to give a shout out to Matt on our hall here. He's a major advocate of slowing your response down. People get really excited. I would say you're driving the big red fire truck, you're running Code 3. Those C's part for you. So it's a pretty cool thing. But it is the most dangerous part of our job, realistically, right? Like, obviously, like, firefighting is really, there's a lot of potential there. But if you're looking, what we do the most is getting to the scene. We're running lights and sirens down a busy corridor. We have a lot of traffic that flows north and south here. Accidents, you are going to injure a lot of people quickly if you're pushing the limits. So he's definitely really, really big on, hey, like, there's a time and a place to run code. And even when you are, just kind of, utilizing those license sirens to move traffic, but you can still do it in a safe manner. And like, what does that timeline look like? We've got a pretty big coverage area here. And if you're looking at us running all the way north, if you're, if you hit everything perfect, running code 3, everybody moves out of the way versus those responses where, Main Street on the highway is all sorts of a cluster and people aren't move, people aren't going to move out of the way. Like, what are you saving? A minute? Like, maybe, right? Like what are we actually saving here? So, time, definitely a time and a place. There's a lot of responsibility that goes on that driver. And yeah, just being comfortable and confident in your skill set. Oh, Jesus. Scott's house is crashing down, apparently. Yeah. But yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, taking that spot serious, not just getting all, jacked up because I'm out there driving the fire truck fast. I think it's super important to realize, like the actual dangers of what you're putting yourself and your crew into. Because the best driver in the world means nothing when the person on the other end of the steering wheel in the other vehicle is driving, recklessly. So it's not just us out there.
Yeah, and if we don't get there, well, we're not helping anybody. So,
absolutely,
like you said, you gotta slow it down. And I mean, even in my job now, like a lot of our response, we've changed our response model a lot now to how we drive and when we go code 3 and when we don't. And it's a lot. It's always up to the driver's discretion. And realistically, in our communities, you can get almost everywhere you need to go in a decent time frame, unless the traffic is really congested and really slowing you down. And that's where the bells and whistles kind of catch people's attention. But the other thing is a lot of people, it's hard to hear the sirens in a lot of these vehicles. The air horn, of course, helps. But the regular siren, it's very hard to hear in these newer vehicles. It's pretty muffled, pretty quiet. So positioning yourself accordingly, like I always teach the guys, like, put that center line right down the center of your steering wheel. But if that oncoming traffic is not moving over to yield, you need to come back on your side of the lane. You cannot stay there. But by doing that, usually that oncoming will see you, and they'll start pulling over, and then the drivers in front of you that can't hear you, they usually notice those vehicles pulling over, and sometimes they clue in to check their mirrors and look behind them, and then, oh, crap, okay, now pull over. But, yeah, you can't get on their ass. You got to stay back because, is that typical driver that might just panic and hit the brakes hard stop. So, you need to be very aware.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice you ever told me about driving tough is that centerline deal. Because, like, I never learned that. And even when I was taking some of the other courses for my other job, the centerline. But that makes so much sense because, yeah, there's people, the people that you're coming up to can't necessarily see you. So they take the cues from the drivers on the oncoming lane. Like, why are those people suddenly pulling over?
So, yeah. It's an extra visual cue, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was kind of our week. Nothing too sexy and exciting, but yeah, a few calls here and there.
Sweet. Well, I think we'll probably call her there. We've been going for a while. We'll start running into our shout outs. So why don't we touch on Modus? Scott?
Modus Snagger Tool. I see, was that a new commercial they have out or is that just a, I see, Luke, was out there doing a Snagger commercial. I don't know how new it was. I saw it on,
Facebook. Yeah, I think I've seen that one before. I could be wrong. Guys, they also pushed our video out again. The one that starts off with your boy here and then goes to I think Josiah or Christian.
Right. Snagger Tool is their biggest claim to fame. I think it's still their biggest seller. They're and like Luke said in the video, he said the number one thing they still use it for is Dragon Host. That's where we first saw it. That's why we first got it. I wouldn't say probably an inch and a half necessarily. Definitely those 2.5s. I use it a lot for that. For when we use, when we're actually flowing water. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot of other stuff. They have, door wedges, soft entry gear. They have bags. One thing we just, yeah, there's one right there, the Lloyd. One thing we started using recently was some of their, little predator, was their utility bags, which make great hydrant kits, hydrant bags. So, and there's some talk of them making a little bit bigger bag for a little bit more stuff for hydrant bags and for, the, apartment packs. For extra gear for that. So, on top of that, they've made the Modus X Pouch, which isn't for sale yet. We're still demoing it. We've had a few different people wear it now. Everybody seems to like it. There's just some modifications, maybe a couple extra little smaller pockets for their for some little wrenches and stuff to go in. But other than that, it's a really good pouch, really good, really easily attachable to your leg and your waist. For that extra little bit of toolkits, toolkit while you're doing an auto extrication. On top of that, they got the X gloves, which are like level 9 cut resistant. A few people are looking for them. Someone was asking us about them for dealing with barbed wire the other day. Someone said, "Hey, can I get some more?" Because
right,
that was actually on deployment because I had given a pair of guys, one of the guys in OK Falls. I said, "Hey, test these out at seminar," and mm-hmm. he tested them. He said, "Man, I use it because he's a rancher." He goes, "Can I get more of those? They're great for handling all the barbed wire fences." I'm like, "How we can find out?" So, yeah. So check them out. DTFF5 will give you 5% off.
Beautiful. Todd, stop the bleed.
Stop the bleed. Yeah, bleeding is bad. You want to stop it. So three methods of massive hemorrhage control is tourniquet application, wound packing, and direct pressure. Go on stopthebleed.org or .ca to find out if there's any courses or instructors near you. If you want to be an instructor, that information on the website can help you do that. And carry a good tourniquet. Make sure it's on you, out of the wrapper. And you can check out our YouTube as well. We've got some information on that.
Absolutely. And then we roll over to Wolf Tree Coffee. So I've been sipping back on the Wolf Tree tonight. Todd's got his branded mug there, which is great. We're enjoying the Initial Attack blend, which is our collab with Wolf Tree. It's their medium dark roast. And $2 of every pound sold of that gets donated back to the Honor House Society in the Lower Mainland. Great charitable society there. Gives first responders a place to stay when they're going down for medical treatment, and also gives access to the Honor Ranch, a great place to go and recover, or if you need a place to get away from everything. For PTSD or anything like that, the Honor Ranch is there for you. So amazing that Wolf Tree Coffee jumped on there, and that partnership is awesome. They've been having a lot of really good success with the Initial Attack blend. So we thank everybody locally and everybody that's been ordering, because after seminar we debuted it back in May in seminar. And, I'm always like, "Hey, does this taste good?" Like, I think it's good. Like, obviously the three of us liked it, but is this really going to get traction? And they say it's selling really, really well. So we appreciate everybody that's been showing them love, that's been buying the product, shipping the product, those locally and not so local. You can find them online. If you just search up Wolf Tree Coffee, they're all over the social medias, and they've got their website for purchase as well. So check them out. Give them some love. It's an amazing product. Sadly, it's doing its job tonight. We're coming up on 11 o'clock and I'm not going to bed anytime soon. So, definitely tastes great and works well. So yeah, Wolf Tree. And then lastly, we have Tanner.
No, Tanner, another new song, Backroad.
Mm-hmm.
Backroad. I was listening to it the other day. I actually sent him a video of us listening to Oregon Hunting. I was like sideways with my truck listening to this song, and my son's filming it, laughing at me. Country music out of the West Coast of Canada. Take a listen, Spotify. Wherever you want to listen to music, and check them out. They're usually touring somewhere local for now. I think they're actually down maybe in the States right now doing some fall fairs. I'm not 100% sure. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, check them out online there. And then lastly, you've got us. We're on the Facebooks, the YouTube, the Instas, the TikToks. I've noticed a few people have been liking and following our old Facebook, which I don't know how we can get rid of that. Maybe we can delete everything off of it. But if you're looking for us on Facebook, make sure it's our, if you can see it, like the new black logo. We're branding ourselves. The orange is going to be specifically for the podcast, where like the black DTFF logo is going to be, more geared towards like everything that we do abroad. So merch, training, so, like all of our stupid videos, things like that. So
actually, I noticed the Stop the Bleed Germany liked our video today.
Oh, yeah. Hey, awesome. Perfect. Yeah, so that's really sweet. And then actually just before we sign off, I made a note here. I wanted to just quickly call back to it. Todd was talking about when he was responding, and he was taking, you know, some cues from some of the, you know, pedestrians. Scott, you had a couple of clues from one of the pedestrians as you were going to a car fire.
Oh man, that guy was giving her. Yeah, he was almost in the middle of the road. He was like pointing, and I'm like, "There's a massive black cloud over the city." Like, actually, I actually thought a house had caught fire because that's how much smoke there was. But I'm like, "Dude, I can see it." like he's pointing, like, and we're like 3 blocks away. Like, he's trying to give me the direction. My truck is going the direction I was going. It wasn't like I was going in the wrong turn or something. And he's just pointing. I was like, "Thanks, man."
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Everybody's trying to help, and I mean, I'm sure he was pumped. So, yeah. I just thought that was a quick, funny story to end on. So, any more from you guys?
Nope. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks. Good night.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this point. We appreciate it. Give us a like, share, subscribe. Gets us out in front of more people. And if you made it this far, if you can give us a message and tell us if this sounds good, bad, indifferent. We're trying a bunch of new things here. Hopefully we're making some improvements along the way. So
buy a shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. GTFF store. Check us out there. You can see everything on Facebook. And then there's an email attached to it. So we still have these shirts available. Selling's been going well, but yeah, there's a few left. So if you're looking for it, you can still pick some up. Yeah, and if that was all, thanks again for listening. And as always, stay safe, stay GTFF.